Hello and welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Overthrows podcast. I'm Behram Kazi, who you can find at Def Mango on Twitter. And with me, as always, is Jared Kimber, who you can find absolutely everywhere. And this show will be, you know, kind of geared towards Australia, who have handed a 10-wicket hammering to India in Adelaide. Jared, the game was done in 6.5 sessions, and now we're all square, headed to the Gabba, and that's quite exciting.
It's exciting for me because I didn't have to get up for five straight days at 4 a.m. So, you know, I think the changing of the Australian pitches to make it so these games are very quick is very good if you happen to be an overseas journo trying to cover these things. So thank you to Kookaburra for juicing up their ball and all this grass on these drop-in pitches. Look, this is the best possible situation going ahead, right? Like, other than maybe India being 1-0 up, so that there's, you know, after two tests, maybe that would be slightly better. But you want the opposition team to win the first game. You don't want the home team to be completely demoralized. You want the series to be still be alive. I think India, probably, if they looked at the schedule and you gave them one all coming out of the first two games, I think they would have bitten your arm off. So I think they're in a great position. I think the next three test matches probably suit them a little bit more. Certainly don't have to worry about Adelaide or Perth anymore, right? So I think they're in a good position going ahead. And from Australia's point of view, shit house in the first test and, you know, rock solid in the second one, you know. Can't ask for more than that. They didn't play very well, then they played well. So both teams should be in a state where they're like, no, this is okay.
Yeah, absolutely. Not just is the series alive, but World Test Championship final qualification is alive as well. So that spices things up a bit further. Also, just a quick shout out to some people in our comments section. Abdul T.S., Gaurav, Arkodeep Datta, Indy23, Sheratan KD, Pranav Arora, Samath Jain, Trishant Khatri, Rahul, Brandon, Stephen. Hello to you guys as well. And let's start talking about some of the main themes and performances. I want to talk about Mitchell Starc, right? He was the one who kind of set the tone for Australia, taking 8 wickets in the game, but more importantly, career best figures of 6-48 in the first innings. And he's got a ridiculous record in day-night test matches. I call him the pink ball pulverizer because that's exactly what he is. You did an entire feature on him as well. And he was generating insane levels of swing, Jared.
I think it should be pink pill pulverizer, by the way. I think you need to be more alliterative with your nickname. Look, it's something that I did a bit of research on this test, and, you know, talked to some people and talked to some people who work with cricket balls and everything about, like, what specifically do we think is the reason it helps Mitchell Starc. You know, I talked to a bowler and as I said, a ball someone involved in the ball making process. And, like, between that, we all sort of came up with the idea of the extra lacquer allows him to swing the ball longer. It also allows him to swing the ball when his wrist isn't perfect. With a red ball, your wrist needs to be quite perfect. With a white ball and a pink ball, it doesn't need to be as perfect for whatever reason. So that's a big advantage to someone like him who's not a great, you know, I mean, he's not a swing bowler, right? He's a bowler who occasionally swings it, which is a very different kind of thing. He's not Jimmy Anderson. You're not going to give him the ball in the 25th over and he's still going to get some swing, right? He could swing it very much up top and then he struggles because he doesn't have this perfect wrist. This pink ball helps with that. The second thing is that in white ball cricket, the ball goes soft, right? That's why we have two of them. It's why we've always had two of them. It's just that no one noticed for years that we had two of them. And now we have two brand new ones to overcome that as well. So we were in a situation where the ball is going to be harder. The lacquer is going to stay on longer and he doesn't need to be as perfect with his wrist to be able to get that kind of movement. So he'll get more bounce. He'll get more swing. These are all things that help him. What I can't explain to you, Behram, is why he specifically is better in Adelaide with the pink ball than in other places. That one's got me a little bit more stumped. But everything else there, I think, makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, and you keep mentioning how the lacquer on the pink ball is different. Well, I think the perfect example of that is the Gill dismissal, you know, in his second dig. So that delivery was landed at a length of 4.32 meters. And generally, that length is a length that batters favor, right? It's on the fuller side. But that ball swung 2.44 degrees and seamed 1.49 degrees, as per Varun, who I had I had him check this. So, I mean, it was generally, you know, an area where batters would capitalize, but it did so much that he literally uprooted Gill's middle stump. And I mean, it was sensational watching Mitchell Starc in this test match. I mean, it was the stuff of dreams because, I mean, sometimes it was just absolutely unplayable. I was wondering, like, how would batters be feeling right now squaring up against Starc with the pink ball?
Yeah, it's quite an interesting one too because We're now starting to see batting specialists against the pick ball, right? So Marnus and Head are coming through. Overseas, it's harder to do that because players don't play.
We might have lost Jared. He is speaking, however.
I am speaking. I was saying it's funny when you think about it because we're starting to come to a point where we have batting specialists with the pink ball. So there clearly is something different about this ball when it comes to batting and everything else. And like, so I've got one here that was given to me years ago, right? And if you feel it compared to a red ball, there is certainly something that's a little bit different. But the thing that have you played with a pink ball before?
Never. I've never played with a pink ball.
So years ago, I was helping a bunch of cricketers.
Not been a thing.
Yeah. So years ago, I was helping someone with learn cricket. And we had a bunch of those softballs, like the ones you play in the backyard with Eek with, right? And they had a white one, an orange one, a yellow one, and whatever. And it was really clear how much easier it was to see the pink ball than all the other balls, than a red ball, than a white ball, than everything else. The pink ball really, really stood out. But what was more fascinating, I found, was that it kind of glows and hums a little bit, right? And so the other thing that could help someone like Mitchell Starc specifically, who is he's running in and he's trying to swing the ball, right? You can't see as clearly the actual seam because there's like a little glow around the ball. So when you have, I do have a white ball over there, but I can't reach it from here, right? So when you have a white ball and you do that, white balls don't glow, right? Wait, can I find my white ball?
How many balls do I have here? This is a very old white ball.
This is a plastic white ball.
He's gone to find his white ball.
I've got so many balls. You know, I've got a basket of balls there. Just for this occasion. Okay. So if you look at the difference, right, the black on the white completely stands out and the black on pink does not, right? So what happens in that kind of situation is that In a normal situation, you could kind of see with a white ball or a red ball if Starc is going to be holding it for swing or holding it for wobble ball, right? So he bowls a three-quarter wobble ball. That's quite extreme. Yeah. You should be able to see that normally, right? And if he's holding it for swing, you should be able to see it. But because of this kind of extra glow off this, and specifically when it's at night, it means that you can't tell the difference between his two deliveries. Now, he's only just started bowling that three-quarter seam wobble ball well in the last maybe year and a half. Like, it's taken him a long time to try and master this and get better at it and everything else. So now you've got someone who can do both. And then, as you said, when he gets all that right, there is a possibility, like, if you get the seam right, there is a possibility for swing and seam at the same time and all this sort of stuff. It's a really hard combination to play. Like, it really does favor his particular kind of bowling more than if you're just going up against a wobble ball bowler. It doesn't matter if you can see the seam or not, because the seam's just going to be doing that the whole time, right? You're getting no clues off that. Whereas usually when you face Starc, there are clues than there is in other places.
So, yeah, the pink ball kind of masks those. And Varun over here has also told us that Starc gets more bounce at Adelaide day-night tests than he does at any other day-night ground. So that could be another reason. But he's not the only seamer who did well for Australia, right? All 20 Indian wickets fell to seam bowling. And captain Pat Cummins, who wasn't looking in rhythm at Perth, right? Like, he was out of sorts over there, but he took 7 wickets in this game, including 5 for 57 in the third innings. Hit the top of Rohit's off stump with a signature Pat Cummins dismissal, and then he regularly bounced batters out. He's hit form at the perfect time, really.
Yeah, we thought that he was starting to bowl better towards the end of the Perth test, but obviously at that stage it didn't matter as much. And, you know, I think I did a thing in, I'll be doing it later about the, you know, what was going to matter and what wasn't going to matter from the first test to the second test, what things might go further into India's advantage, and what things might swing back into Australia's. I was pretty confident that Cummins was in form by the time they got there. Even in the first innings where it maybe didn't show on the scoreboard as well as much. I thought he was probably the third best bowler in the third innings, but I still thought he was pretty good at that time. Whereas by the time we got to the second innings, as you said, like, he looked great against the top order players. And then, do you remember at the Wacker? It looked like he wasn't sure he should be bowling bouncers. Like, I'm not saying he was not fit, but it looked like he didn't trust himself to bowl the bouncers when they needed them, right? Here, he was just like, okay, the game was over. He didn't need to. He could have just bowled at the top of off and waited to win that game. He's like, no, it's much safer if we whip them out quickly. And the best way to whip them out quickly is just to bowl really accurate bouncers. They were fast. They were accurate. They were, you know, on point with good field settings. He looked like he was back.
Yeah, no, absolutely. In Australia, like, you know, 15 of the 20 wickets fell to Stark and Cummins, of course, but they were without the services of their premier seamer, Josh Hazlewood, in this game, who has been their best seamer in Test cricket for the last little while. I personally thought going into this Test match, that's going to be a big miss for them, and his absence is going to be felt, but that wasn't particularly the case, because Scotty Boland ended with 2 for 54 and 3 for 51. So he took the remaining 5 wickets, and based on that, do you reckon he might get some more game time in this Border Gavaskar Trophy?
I actually thought he was the best bowler in the first innings. I know Stark got all the wickets, and but I thought Boland was the best bowler that we saw in the first innings. And realistically, I think he bowled much better than just 5 wickets in this game. But everyone was in form in the end, and you share them how you share them, right? The issue with Boland is that when you don't have the pink ball, I think India have worked out what England worked out, which is you can't defend him. Right? I would say in world cricket... And I'd include Bumrah in this and Rabada and maybe even Henry. I don't think there's a player that is harder to defend than Boland, right? Those other guys make it hard because you also can't play attacking shots against them that easy. Henry, a little bit easier, but not particularly. Rabada, you could score off Rabada quickly, but it's always a risk. And off Bumrah, obviously, you just can't score. And what you can do against Boland, though, is attack him. And he doesn't have what the other three have available to them when he's attacking. So I don't think I necessarily need to keep him around. If Hazlewood is fit for the next test, I'd bring Hazlewood back in. But what they have now is the ability to rest one of Stark or Cummins if they want to further on. I think what a lot of people will look at is that Nathan Lyon didn't do that much in the first two tests, and so therefore they don't really need Nathan Lyon. That's the wrong way of looking at it, because if the ball had gone soft at one stage, they would have been in a situation where they could have done that. So they would have needed Lyon. Also, they're probably going to need Lyon in the next three tests more than they did in the first two tests anyway. They don't want to be in a situation where... they don't want to be in a situation where Mitchell Marsh has to bowl some of the dog overs. They don't want to be in a situation where Pat Cummins or Josh Hazlewood has to bowl some of the dog overs. Lyon is there to bowl the dog overs. And so, you know, from that perspective, he makes a lot more sense. So I'm not too worried that he hasn't played a big part in the game before. He's played well against India in Australia previous times. These are very different conditions, though. So if they might just come to a point where they're just like, look, we've got 4 frontline seamers, and then if we can get 10 overs a day out of Mitchell Marsh, that's enough. The issue is whether they can get 10 overs a day out of Mitchell Marsh, and, you know, it doesn't look like...
That is an issue.
Yeah, I just don't know if they can.
No, and I mean, I asked you this question during the game that, like, was it even worth playing Nathan Lyon? And that's what you kind of responded to me with, that, you know, you can't just plan that you'll be dominating the game, and you have to kind of think about those dog overs 50 to 80 when the ball is soft. And it kind of made sense to me after that. Also, a fun fact by Varun over here, that Scotty Boland is the only bowler on our database whose balls per dismissal for defensive shots is lower than the balls per dismissal for attacking shots. So that's quite interesting as well. And I mean, like, build the man a statue already, guys. What are you doing? But anyway, despite all this brilliant seam bowling, you know, performance from Australia, Travis Head bagged the Player of the Match award courtesy of a swashbuckling 140 with the bat. He scored that, you know, tally off just 141 deliveries. I mean, he took down Ashwin, like literally took him down. And then he was also on the charge versus Harshit Rana and Siraj as well, getting into a proper tussle with the latter. And he really loves playing against India, doesn't he?
He does. He's not Player of the Match, though. That's absolute nonsense. Mitchell Stark said this.
Oh, he's not?
Well, I mean...
I would have given it to Stark as well.
I mean, Stark set the game up. What Travis Head came in after Marnus and McSweeney had seen off the new ball, when Bumrah was rested, when it was a little bit softer, when there were no lights on, and he was dropped twice. Like, Mitchell Stark took 6 wickets to start the game to get Australia into the position where Travis Head could benefit from. It's just, again, absolutely ridiculous. Agreed. The way they give these awards, especially in Test cricket, right, where the bowlers win new games, and batters still dominate that award. It's so stupid. That's why I hate that award. You know, Rob Barron bets on it all the time. And he's like, it's really good because it's one of the few things where the bookmakers don't know what they're doing. So they put up really, really bad odds quite a lot because of this. And I'm like, yeah, but if I had a big bet on South Africa the other day with the second new ball, right? And they just couldn't, they took a wicket early on. They just couldn't take another wicket. Eventually, I just had to get out of my bed. It wasn't going the way that I needed it to be because there were drop catches, there were half chances, you know, all those things happening. That's normal cricket stuff. I can't handle a bunch of people who don't even spend that time thinking about a thing, voting for it, and that being where my bets is on, right? Like, that is what it is. Like, my friends have done it before. I don't think, no, I've never, I think I was asked to do it once, but it was a game I wasn't at, weirdly enough. You know, I've never had to do it before or whatever, but I know the people who do, and I know how little time they put into coming up with it, and it does my head in. Having said all of that, I thought Travis Head was incredible, and his ability to flip a game so quickly. I thought he looked like he was struggling when he first came out. He didn't look as fluent as he normally would. I thought, well, India's got a chance here when he was about 11 of 22 of getting rid of him. But once you don't get rid of him, that's the problem, isn't it? It's like him and Harry Brook are exactly the same. Harry Brook might have made more runs, but it's the same impact. Once they're in, you're just like, where do we bowl to them? And Rishabh Pant, you can throw him in as well. All the number fives, right? There's an element of those three players at the moment of once they are set, no one seems to have a very good plan of what to do for them. And that is why Australia decided to drop Shane Keith Warne. Cricket is a game of strategy, of picking the right players for the right moment, or playing the right shots at the right ball. And Hit Wicket captures that perfectly. In Hit Wicket, you're not just picking a team, you're collecting cricket legends, expanding your squad with each new addition. The more players you have, the more options you have to dominate in any situation. And then comes the real challenge, picking your playing 11. Who are your opener, run machine, and Mr. 360? Do you stack your top order with aggressive batters, or do you build a solid foundation? And what about your bowling attack? Do you go with pace, spin, a mixture of both? We've got the Tasmanian Devil, Jimmy, and Boom. The possibility are endless. The beauty of Hit Wicket is that you need to adapt your lineup to your opponent. They can be powerful, balanced, and technical. Each class has an edge over another. It's a tactical dance where you need to anticipate your opponent's moves and exploit their weaknesses. So if you think you've got the strategic mind to build a championship team, download Hit Wicket and prove it.
Yeah, and Travis Head is like a proper counterpunch, which literally can knock you out. Like an hour and two or two of Travis Head can like decimate you in the game, and that's what happened over here. And of course, you know, Bumrah wasn't bowling early on when he came out to bat. Of course, there are other reasons as well, which we'll get into. And then Siraj dropped Head's catch on 76. There was another chance that went between the slip cordon. And funny on Siraj, right? Ended up with decent figures, 4 for 98 with the ball. But he'll be remembered for different reasons in this test. And I know Head also complained about Siraj's behavior. But personally, I saw nothing wrong with it. Like, when you're a fast bowler, even if you're playing like tape ball cricket amongst friends and you're carted around for fours and sixes and you clean up the batter in that very over, it's likely or it's only human to be a bit animated. And I mean, I don't see what was wrong with that. It just feels very natural. And I feel like too much has been made of it.
Oh, too much has definitely been made of it. But if you stop in the middle of the pitch and scream at a batter who's just slammed you for 100 in his hometown, A, the crowd is going to boo you. And B, you look like an idiot. And C, you are being a dick, right? There's no hiding any of that, right? Like, there's no reason to ever send off a batter. You have sent them off. That's what the delivery did. You got them out. You have won the battle. They can't do anything after that because they have to leave the ground, right? And so anything the batter says looks kind of weak and stupid anyway. You've already won the battle. That's why send-offs are not part of cricket, right? Because there's a power imbalance there that doesn't make any sense. A batter and a bowler can sledge each other when they're in the heat of battle and no one has any issue with that. But once the game, once it's over, and he wasn't the only one to do it. Scott Boland did one as well. His was more of a flyby. But again, it's just like, just stop being dicks. You don't need to do that. You've won that moment. Specifically though, in Siraj's case, the game was gone. Head had completely crushed them. You just look like an idiot when you send someone off in that situation. But, you know, I've got no problem with the emotion side of it, as you said, and all that sort of stuff. I've got no problem with the Adelaide crowd reacting the way that they did. You know, that's good theater of professional sport. But, like, if you do something like that, you do look like a dick, right? Like, there is an element of, mate, scoreboard, right? You know, you bowled me. I've made 100. You bowled me with a fucking full toss and you're fucking sending me off. Settle down, champ. You know what I mean? And so, you know, that you want Siraj to be doing that when he gets him out for 10, not when he gets him out for 110.
I mean, there might be some frustration at play because Siraj was the one who dropped Head on 76 when the lead was like, what, 48 or something, right? And had he got that catch, you never know how this game would have panned out, right? So I feel like there was a bit of that over there as well. Plus, I agree with the fact that, you know, everyone knows this is Travis Head's hometown. He's South Australia's very own. They literally own that player. And you could see from the celebrations from the crowd as well. So it is kind of shooting yourself in the foot because you know that you'll be booed.
It's worth saying, and I think we might have done this on a podcast ages ago. I can't remember if it was with you or with Barrett. That might have been with you when we went through the South Australian team of all time. It's not a particularly good team.
No, it wasn't me. It wasn't.
Yeah, I remember I went through, I might not have even been with Barrett. I might have been with someone else. But I remember doing a podcast on it and bringing it up. It's a particularly terrible team. You know, they've had a couple of good players come through. Obviously, the Chapel family, not that they're all Chapels, but the Chapel family have three, I think, of the 11 to begin with, right? There's like players, there's an overseas player in there. I can't remember if it's Sobers or Barry Richards, but there's an overseas player in there. There's Rodney Hogg, I think, is in it. And Rodney Hogg is like a Victorian player.
Jason Gillespie.
Yeah, so they got Jason Gillespie.
Dizzy's
got
to be in there.
They've got the three Chapels. They've got Jason Gillespie and Darren Lehman. So there's two statues.
Alex Carey. Count Alex Carey?
I don't think they had Alex Carey in that team, but Alex Carey's not from South Australia either.
He's not?
Actually, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe he is from South Australia. I know he played football in New South Wales.
No, he lives down the road. I think he lives down the road from Travis Head or something.
No.
Because in the test, the documentary, when Carey gets picked, he goes and meets Travis Head.
But that's a different thing. That's where he lives now. Just let me check. I might be wrong. I thought he was originally he's from South Australia. Phew, we're okay with him. He wasn't in that side yet. They had another week. I think they had Graham Manu or someone else, right? They might have had Barry Jarman. Mm-hmm. In as their wicketkeeper, which again, not a big not a big name. Even if you put Alex Carey in there, not a big name. There's two statues up in the ground of Darren Lehman and Jason Gillespie. Jason Gillespie, a fine player to have a statue of. Darren Lehman, not an international great, right? And then, as I said before, you've got your players from other states. You've got Clary Grimmett, who's their best spinner. He's from New Zealand, right? He also played in New South Wales and Victoria on the way to South Australia. It's a big deal for them to have a player like this. Is my point, right? This is not a normal thing. And the last really good South Australian player they had, born and bred, is probably Ryan Harris. He had one great year for South Australia, and then they had a falling out with him and he moved to Queensland, right? The player before that is probably what? Callum Ferguson or Sean Tate? Both very talented. Both we didn't quite see the best of at international level. Lehman, very good player, doesn't crack test cricket at the top level the way that everyone expected him to. You've got Greg Blewett. It's a big deal for Travis Head to be potentially the best all-format player in the world from South Australia, looking at their entire history, right? So if he's going to smash you for 100 and then you're going to go into face of him, that's what you saw. And well done to all 20,000 fans in Adelaide Oval that were actually in the ground, because the rest are out the back drinking anyway and wouldn't have even known what Siraj did.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, you can ill afford to give an opportunity to a guy like Travis Head. But on that note, right, sure, he got dropped at 76 and then there was another chance. And I mean, Pant also dropped McSweeney earlier in the piece, which should have been caught. But if you compare these howlers to how Australia were fielding and all the lapses and missed opportunities, even at the start of the game, right? KL was dismissed off a no-ball off Scotty Boland. Then he was dropped by Khwaja. Then I can count at least like four other drops by Australia in this match. And then they also didn't take the review on Boland's bowling once again when he had Nitish Rana plumb LBW for a duck. Despite all of those things, Australia still won.
Yeah, I think, I can't remember if we talked about this recently, but it's about the chances, right? Actually, it might have been me and Varun talking about this, of like people over-index on catches, but they under-index on the amount of chances that you need to make. So if you don't make 26 chances per test match, right? Like it doesn't, generally, there's always going to be, you might forget to appeal for something. You know, there might be like a mistake by DRS or an umpire. You might run out of reviews. Miscatch. I think there was a point at one stage where Ashwin was on his hands and knees in the field and missed a run out opportunity, right? Like all those things, that's a normal thing to have happen to you in any test match, right? So you just have to produce more chances. No one watching this test match didn't think that the Australian bowlers weren't producing significantly more chances, right? And as you said, and the other side of that is then Head, once you do that, there's no putting the genie back in the bottle. Like, you know, it's Aladdin time. I don't know why he would be Aladdin in this I'm not sure he's the genie. I'm not sure if he's Robin Williams or Will Smith. I'm not sure I went with this.
He would definitely be the genie. Come would on,
he,
Travis.
He's not Robin Williams, though, is he? He's probably, is he more? No, and maybe he is Robin Williams the way he bats. I don't know. I mean,
he's not a street rat, Jared. Definitely not a street rat, as Aladdin was. But anyway, there was also one outstanding bowler for India, of course. The pick of their bowlers, as always, Jasprit Bumrah, who contributed with 4 for 61 in the first innings, looked unplayable at times, and the commentators couldn't stop talking about how there were two different games of cricket going on, one when Bumrah was bowling and one when the other Indian seamers were bowling. And to Cheyenne's delight, and all of us at Good Areas, Bumrah is now averaging below 20 in Test cricket, 19.96 to be exact, which is absolutely unreal. But he was struggling for fitness and he did pull up in between. And that has got to be a major concern for India, given that there are three more tests and they're back-to-back tests right now. There's not much of a break between now and the test match at the Gabba, and India need Bumrah.
There's not much gap between really the test now and the test in Sydney, if you think about it.
Yeah.
You know, it's three tests on the fly. I know there's a bit of a gap between each one, but it's not like they're massive. I think it's a bit unfair. I thought Siraj bowled quite well at times in this test match. He didn't get the wickets that perhaps he deserved, but people sort of over-index on that. There is an element of, if you're the bowler at the other end to Bumrah, it doesn't really matter what you do. It's very hard to be noticed, right? And so I do think with Siraj specifically, that was an issue. But it does feel more and more like a two-person bowling attack at the moment, right? And that might change as whether it be Ashwin or Jadeja or Sundar in the next test matches, and they might get conditions that help them a little bit more, you know, slightly longer-lasting test matches. The one thing I would say is it was a two-day test. What was the last one? A four-day test? Is that right? That's only 6 days of cricket.
Yeah. Yep, you're right.
There's a long break in between. Yes, he did. He looked sore. But whether he looked sore or cramped, I still don't know. I mean, it didn't look like a normal cramp to me, but it could have been something like that. The only time I was a bit, I wouldn't say upset, a bit more worried, was when he bowled at 120 kilometers an hour. And I get it. Like, why bowl at full pace? Like, it doesn't actually make sense for him to bowl at full pace. But I was thinking to myself, why is he bowling then? And is this an issue? And, you know, that confused me a little bit. I thought they used him quite well. The problem at the moment is, and, you know, I talked about this during the test, is essentially when he doesn't bowl, everyone says he should be bowling, right? The minute he gets injured, everyone's going to say he's been overbowled, right?
Yeah, it's a catch-22 situation, really. I mean, this was the conversation basically during the first session of day two, because Bumrah came in early on in the day, took two wickets in four overs, and then we didn't see him up until the afternoon session. And, you know, even us, Alok, myself, Cheyenne, we were chatting in the Good Areas WhatsApp chat, and I was like, where is Bumrah? And they were like, we have no clue. He should be coming in for a short burst before tea, is it? Yeah, lunch is tea in day-night tests. And I was like, the only thing that makes sense to me over here is that he's struggling for fitness. And then, I don't know if it was a cramp, because he was kind of holding his groin, which had me concerned, because I want to see Jasprit Bumrah in all five test matches. But at that like kind of same moment, you kind of feel sorry for Rohit Sharma, because he's going to get blasted for this, right? The game that he didn't play, India won, and now he's back as captain, already under pressure after losing 3-0 to New Zealand. People are going to slam Rohit Sharma's captaincy once again. And I'm not saying there weren't mistakes. I did feel that he let Australia off the hook at times. He should have attacked more. He should have searched for wickets. But not bowling Jasprit Bumrah over there might just be a fitness thing, right? It might not be Rohit's fault.
I actually think, and I went through it on one of the scoreboard shows, must have been the one at the end of day two. I actually think it was just a weird set of circumstances when you go back. They had, they wanted to give him two bites of the ball before stumps on day one. So that meant that he bowled a long spell. They gave him a decent pause, and then he came back right at the end. They clearly wanted to use him at the start of day two. They probably would have wanted to use him one more time during that day, but there was there was an element of when the new ball was going to be involved, which also played a part. And so they probably came up with a plan of, let's use him at the start of the day, try and get some wickets, and then use him straight after the break and try and get some wickets. Then you couldn't bowl him after that because of the situation. But by the time he got the second new ball, him and Siraj were still, I think Siraj was like two overs ahead of him in the count. And yes, Siraj, let's say the innings went longer, Siraj wouldn't have bowled the next spell. They would have had to bring Bumrah back. So he's not underbowled him, no matter how you look at that, right? It's just that it was a weird situation because of the different breaks, because of the pink ball under lights, because of when they wanted to use him and everything else. So the issue then becomes, as you said, of like cramp, usually you're in agony. He didn't really look like he was in agony. So that to me doesn't look like cramp. Like, I mean, they might still say it is, but as a, you know, perennial cramper, and I've cramped in my groin, I've cramped in every part of my body, right? Like, I'm aware of what cramp does. There are some parts of your body where it doesn't make you scream, but it still makes you sort of either double over or whatever. Like, if you get cramp in your body, there's usually a bit more going on. I don't know what happened there, but that's the thing. On the same day, everyone was saying they've got to bowl him more. We then see him on the ground for 10 minutes, right? So like, there's no good answer for this at the moment. The best answer is Shami. And, you know, I talked to Saurabh Samani and he's just like, the word in India is that Shami is not ready to play a test match at the moment, right? So we get so many comments on our you know, live videos with people going, oh, they have to bring Shami in.
Well,
then they know why he's not here, right? They're not holding him back because they're being arrogant or pig-headed. There's a reason. They have seen him bowl and they've seen him recover, and there is something within that that is worrying them at the moment, and that's why he's not in a test match would be my guess. And at this stage, it looks like Sydney or Melbourne will be the most likely test for him to play. I'd be shocked if he's playing. So that means that you have to carry Bumrah through all five tests probably.
Yeah, and I mean, they probably need to bowl Bumrah in all five test matches. It's a shame though that Shami still hasn't recovered, because India definitely need him. Also off topic, but has your pinky toe ever cramped? That's the worst one. Has that ever happened to you?
I don't know if we've ever had this conversation before, but I have something, and I think the name of it is brachymetasria. Try and get that name right. But we call it the raptor claw in our family. So my little toe is permanently up. And it's, I think all the kids have had it at various times, but they've grown out of it. But it's a thing that happens. So my pinky toe doesn't really do anything at all. It probably would have been better if I was a kid, if it was taken off. And some people with brachymetasria do actually do that sort of stuff. So there you go. So no, I don't think I've ever had my little toe cramp, only because I don't think my little toe has the same nerve endings of my other toes, but I've certainly had my toes do it. I think the worst one I ever had was when my arm was broken from one end to the other, and I had it in my arm at the same time. That's the worst cramp I've ever had. But I've had some really bad ones. I get it in random parts of my body all the time. I'm pretty good now at like controlling it and not having it. But, you know, when I see Glenn Maxwell or, you know, and those sorts of guys, I'm like, yeah, I'm with you. I get that. Not our man who fakes it in Pakistan, but he's a legend too.
It's interesting how you lost an inch off your arm and now you're Len Hutton. And if they did remove your toe, you would have been Martin Guptill, maybe, right?
Did Martin Guptill, is he missing two toes or one?
He's missing two toes.
Yeah. I think also, you might remember this, the guy who took the hat trick for Australia in the Commonwealth Games, Bradley Young. Do you remember him?
I think I remember him.
Yeah, left arm finger spinner. Played a little bit, mid-90s to maybe early 2000s. I reckon he was missing toes as well. I don't know how many other cricketers have ever been missing toes. But I'm sure there's a couple.
Well, Pat Cummins has this middle finger, which is kind of compromised. And Waqar Yunus has like, what, two fingers on one hand? I think that's it. He's missing like one or two fingers or something.
Garfield so Sobers, I don't know what, this is just the digit episode suddenly, but the Garfield Sobers was born with an extra finger in each hand.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Well, he was...
First one they took off with a knife, and I think he took the second one off himself with catgut.
Holy shit. I was going to say so he was bad. Just that, you know, extra finger better than everyone else, but now that joke doesn't make sense. Anyway, that note, let's take a short break.
His teammates used to call him, used to say he cheated because he had extra fingers. Anyway, sorry, go. We'll have a break.
We'll be taking a short break and we'll see you just in a moment. You're watching Overthrows with Jared and Behram. Go nowhere. We still have more stuff to talk about.
And that is why Nasser Hussain decided to bowl first at the go. And this all, of course, reminds me of Hit Wicket, which is a mobile cricket strategy game that is all about making those tough decisions. Who do you want to send in as an opener when the asking rate is climbing? Do you go for the big hitter or the steady accumulator? Me, I like to throw in someone a little bit unorthodox, a bit of a wild card like the general. That keeps the opposition guessing. And what about the bowling attack? Do you unleash your express pace early or hold back for the death overs? I'm always tempted to bring on a mystery spinner in the middle overs and just try and break a partnership. Hit Wicket puts you in the captain's chair. You draft the squad and select the batting order and even decide when to use those game-changing abilities. Do you burn your 2x ability to chase down a big total? Or save it for a critical moment later on? It's strategic, it's addictive, and it's more nerve-wracking than facing a show of Akhtar Bouncer. Give it a go. Download Hit Wicket and see if you've got the tactical nous to win.
Welcome back to the Overthrows podcast. You guys are with Jared and Bairam. And Jared, we spoke about how, you know, the Bumrah situation had Rohit's captaincy under the scan. And of course, that is a catch-22 situation because you don't want to break him either, right? But I really want to talk about his decision to bat at six with you. I understand that KL Rahul had a good game in Perth and you kind of want him to maintain his role as opener. But number six, I mean, you know how ruthless people are in India and some of the media people as well. And when you're a captain and you're coming to bat at six, it could give off the wrong impression and then put even more pressure on you.
Well, to be fair, he would bat at five, right? He would bat ahead of Rishabh Pant, but Rishabh Pant's left-handed.
Yeah.
So I think you find it hard in that situation to be too critical. I mean, people will be critical anyway. I mean, it feels like Rohit Sharma didn't just win a World Cup. Right. The way that people are talking about him,
it feels
like Rohit Sharma did not win a World Cup. Like sometimes I have to stop and go, did they win the World Cup? Because it now feels like that already automatically didn't happen. Like I catch myself and sometimes I think, was he not the captain? Because like you're suddenly being told he can't captain. I was like, did he not captain a World Cup victory?
Was he not at the forefront?
Was he not
at the forefront of all of India's shift to attacking cricket? Did that not happen?
Was he not the one that tried to make them play the way that they played that won them the World Cup? So look, people are going to hate him. He's either going to make runs or he's not going to make runs. I don't think it matters if he's at six or not. Does that make sense? I would have batted him down the order. I think right at the moment, they look like a slightly better lineup with Kyle Rahul at the top. And then Rohit at number six still averages over 50 in Test cricket. Like I think people can over-index. I think I've mentioned this before, but the whole Shane Watson, Rohit Sharma thing of like, sometimes when you come back into the side, you are placed in a position because that is the position that is available to you and you're in your best form and you make it work. Mm. And then you work out how to do it over time when you struggle a little bit. That's how I feel Rohit is as an opener. He's probably still more suited to batting in the middle order than he is opening the batting, right? And, you know, you've got Shane Watson, you've got Mike Hussey is probably another player like that. Like you see these sorts of things all around the world, right? Where it's like, you know, where's the spot that's available to me? I'm going to go play that and I'm in good form, so I'm going to make runs. You know, Sehwag is another perfect example of someone like that, right?
Hmm.
Warner. There's heaps of these players that, like, you end up in that spot by accident. And, like, you know, I don't think this Crick Picks is out yet, but the one about the number fives and, you know, you mentioned Mike Hussey in that, right? Like Mike Hussey to me is an opener because I spent 10 years watching him in domestic cricket opening the batting, right? I know he's an opener. I know he's a really good opener. And then he came in and he made runs opening the batting for Australia, but they couldn't fit him in as an opener, right? So they moved into another position. Yeah. The point being is sometimes we kind of get a little bit obsessed with those sorts of things. And, you know, I could go through the list of, you know, top order players who have ended up being good in other positions or middle order players who've ended up opening or batting at three. When you're in that sort of form and you're that level of player. So I've got no issue with Rohit Sharma coming down the order. I've got issues with the fact Rohit Sharma can't make any runs no matter where he bats. All right.
Yeah.
And a similar one would be Steve Smith. We've just been through this conversation with Steve Smith, right? Of like, everyone's like, oh, yep. He's going back to number four now. How does everyone feel about him being back at number four right at the moment, right? Like he's continued his drought at number four. There are technical reasons why certain batters, usually flawed batters, need to bat in different spots, right? There are sometimes reasons within a side why it makes sense to bat people in certain orders. And there is a familiarity that you get batting in a certain spot, right? Like these days, I probably mostly bat at number three or number four when I'm playing in club cricket, right? Mm-hmm. And when I was younger, I would either open or bat six or seven, right? And so if I was asked to bat number seven right now, I think I'd have to be like, okay, what's that again? How do I do that? How do I work that out?
In your Len Hutton era,
you're not batting at 6 or 7, mate. You're definitely batting 3 or 4.
Yeah, I'm not opening. I can tell you, I'm not going that far with the Len Hutton. But the point being is that there is an element of that at times, right? You know, and I think Moinelli is one of the best case scenarios of a player who was batting too low down the order and it just screwed with his head, right? And there are plenty of players who play slightly out of position because of that. That doesn't work. I think there are then players who are Rohit Sharma has the game to bat anywhere from 1, 2, 6. Right, he'd be a very good number 3. Mm-hmm. He's probably a number 4, but Virat Kohli is a number 4. He's got no problem with batting number 5, and he would also be. He averages over 50, I think, in Test cricket, batting at number 6. That might have come down after this Test match, but people are going to over-index on that. But the truth is, he wasn't making runs beforehand, opening the bat as well. Mm. He's just going through a little bit of a slump, and these things happen. Yeah. And as you said, now every single mistake that happens in Indian cricket, and it's one of those things that if he had played in that first test, opened the batting and been part of them winning the game, it would have eased off. But it's one of those fluke things where he wasn't involved in that first test and they've won it. And so now it's like, well, when Rohit's not here, we're great. And when Rohit's here, we're terrible. And it's like, again, did you or did you not win a World Cup with Rohit Sharma as your captain?
Yeah.
It's a bit like the Owen Morgan one where like when Owen Morgan had a bad year at Kolkata and all the Kolkata fans are like, he's not a good captain. It's like, my guys, he literally turned around the worst white ball setup in world cricket, right? Almost won a bunch of T20 World Cups and won an ODI World Cup. And it's like, I can understand he's not playing well at the moment. He's not batting very well and you'll be upset at him. But let's not talk shit. And that's what happens in these sorts of situations, right? Like, I went from having a week of everyone telling me India was going to win 5-0 to a day and a half of everyone telling me that Australia's going to win 4-1. Like, everyone is just overreacting in every direction possible.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I mean, there ain't no goat like a scapegoat, particularly in the subcontinent. So everyone's been after Rohit for a while now, ever since those New Zealand test matches. And they make it seem like his captaincy is the reason they're losing. I mean, a bigger issue right now is the runs that he's not scoring. He's averaging, what, 12 in the last 10 test matches or something? And he bats 1 or 6. If he's not scoring runs, then of course he's going to come under the scanner. But honestly, again, it's not his decision to bat at 6 or the fact that he didn't bring on Bumrah at that particular point in time. Why India have lost this? They've lost this game because they couldn't bat at all. Like, Nitish Reddy was their best batter in both innings, who scored 42 in each innings. And I mean, I enjoyed his counterattack. There was that one reverse scoop that he played and then there was this 1-6 over extra cover. But then if Nitish Kumar Reddy is your highest scorer in both innings, then you've got a problem over here. And that's probably the reason why you've lost.
I would go a step further. I would say if you look at their lineup at the moment, so we did this on the scoreboard this morning, I think. I think I was awake for scoreboard. I think I did it, Bayram. and we had the most runs. So Nitish Reddy has the second most runs for India without a 50. That's already a red flag. I know it's only 2 tests in, but it's already a red flag. But then you go through, Jaiswal has the most runs, KL Rahul, Kohli. Right? That's all from one innings. Mm-hmm. And then you start to think about it, and you're like, outside of Nitish Reddy, they have only really had one innings so far. Right now, Australia's only had one innings as well, right? So it's not as if the opposite, you know, McSweeney did a better job in this test match and Marnus looked a little bit more informed. Usman still failed in the first innings, right?
Yes.
So you've got a situation at the moment where you've got a situation at the moment where you are very much one all, but one all with some holes, right? The third seamer is
massive holes.
Third seamer is still a question mark. Bumrah's fitness is a question mark. And they're not making runs. But Australia has equal holes, right? Like maybe their bowling lineup looks a little bit more solid. But I can tell you which top order I want to go into the next test match with. And it isn't Australia's, is it? Right? Like, I mean, let's be honest.
Yeah.
Even the middle order, you'd still be going, oh, maybe, you know, even with Head in there, you know, Marsh and Carey, you might still think to yourself, I don't know, Rohit, Rishabh and Nitish Reddy at the moment might look in slightly better form. You might not make that, but the point being is it's a conversation, at least. It's not an automatic. So, you know, there are major issues there. I think if Rohit made runs, his captaincy would be better and it would have nothing to do with his captaincy.
Yeah, it's interesting you mention Australia's batting, right? Because McSweeney, sure, he got some runs, but he's still very, very new to the scene and I wouldn't like have him as my opener if I'm making a team amongst both sides, right?
If you wouldn't have him if your opener, if you had another opener.
Yeah, basically. And I mean, there are massive holes on either side. Steve Smith still cannot buy a run. And it's interesting how you don't see people, you know, jump on his case the same way. Yes, people have talked about how, you know, age might have an effect on his reaction time and his shuffly sort of manner of batting might be impacted. But then again, people were saying similar things about Marnus. You did a whole feature piece on him. He ended up with 64 runs in that innings, right? And there were only 250 plus scores. One was Head's 140, and then there was Marnus's 64. He batted in a very, very tricky period in that evening session on day one. And he survived that session, then looked in control in the morning, right? He was playing his shots. He looked more confident. Got out playing one of those shots as well. But that's some respite for him because Marnus was also going through a treacherous run of form.
I thought he looked the best batter in the game. Travis Head eventually became belligerent, but he had to be missed a couple of times in order to become belligerent. Marnus looked like he was batting on wheels. He looked like the old Marnus where you're just like, okay, he's going to leave everything outside off stump. And the minute you get too straight, he's going to knock you through mid-wicket. You're going to move your square leg to mid-wicket. Then he's going to knock you through square leg. He's going to pick up the runs. It was a loose shot, and he should be really upset at that and will be really upset at that knowing Marnus because he should have made it. He should have made a big score. He was completely on top of India. And if Bumrah or Siraj bowls an incredible ball or Ashwin turns one or keeps one low or something, you're like, these things happen. When the fifth bowler comes on and is bowling 125 kilometers an hour and bowls just a innocuous ball outside off stump, there is no reason to hit that in the air, right? That is just one that, like, he could have just got on top of that, which he'd been playing that shot quite well. Just get on top of it, and then you go, well, if I hit it along the ground, that's fine. They field it. But if not, it's a cheeky four without really any risk at all. There's no reason to put risk into that shot.
Yeah. And I'm so happy that you and Varun recorded that Marnus footmarks, and I made you guys publish it earlier because now he's gotten 64 and it wouldn't have made much sense after. So this is why you hired me, Jared. But anyway, I'm happy for Marnus. I think that him coming into form is good for everybody because I like him as a character and I don't want him to be dropped, and he was on the verge of being dropped. Maybe Steve Smith kind of overcomes his demons in the next test. It will be at the Gabba, Jared. And I mean, I feel like Australia will probably go unchanged. There will be this temptation to go with four seamers, but then Nathan Lyon has a fantastic record at the Gabba and he extracts a ridiculous amount of bounce over there. So I think he's still going to play. As for India, however, you know, they need a proper third seamer. As much as I like Harshit Rana and I was impressed with him in the first game and he was cranking it up in this game, right? 140 plus. I feel like he's probably got to go. Sheraton KD over here with the Super Chat has mentioned the same thing, that he feels like Prasidh Krishna might be selected for the Gabba because he bowls good bouncers. And, well, he's saying they don't want to risk Bumrah Siraj with bouncer work. I don't feel like that's Bumrah's job. He has a lot of other deliveries as well. And Sheraton feels that Krishna sucks. But it's a problem, is the point. Because Shami's probably still not fit. And they want to kind of switch something. And maybe even Jadeja comes in for this test match ahead of Ashwin. There are a lot of questions over here.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I'm not sure that Ashwin did anything wrong in this test match. It was just that the catch wasn't taken. I actually thought he bowled reasonably well. He was trying to slide one
and
through.
And also, he got a bonus.
He did get a wicket that wasn't a wicket. Yeah, he got a bonus about wicket. That. So I suppose maybe it was one all when it came to those sorts of things. But I didn't think he bowled poorly at all. I think the bigger issue in world cricket has always been the same thing of like people just overreact to no wickets and underreact to wickets. And, you know, do you know what I mean? Whereas this like people don't like me saying that Boland bowled better than Stark or that Marnus batted better than Head. But it's like, but these things are pretty undeniable if you go back through and have a look at what happened. Right. I thought he bowled fine, Ashwin. So I can't see any reason why they would make a third change. Like, unless they think they need the extra batting. And if you've got Jadeja at seven and Nesh Reddy at eight, you've got issues to begin with. I think you'd rather have, especially in Brisbane and Melbourne, I'd rather have a taller spinner than a shorter spinner. Might be a little bit different in the SCG when they get there. But in the other two, I'd probably rather have taller spinners for the way that goes. Prasidh Krishna might come in. I don't know if he's a great bouncer bowler, though. He's tall. Those are two different things.
What about Akash Deep? Akash Deep is also an option, right?
I don't think. I mean, the problem with Akash Deep is they just had the test match to play him in, and they didn't play him in it. He should have played in this test match. And then Harshit Rana, this is the thing. Harshit Rana is probably the ideal bowler for Brisbane, but now the confidence is going out of him. And so, you know, they're not in the right situation. I think Akash Deep would have been so hard to play at first change with that pink ball. And they probably missed a trick there. And they look, they went with the young guy who they remember, we didn't think Rana was going to play at Perth, and they pulled off a blinder there and it worked really well for them. It didn't work for them here. And so now they've got themselves in a tricky situation from that point of view. If you just want pressure, Akashjeet probably makes more sense. If you want a bowler who is more suited to Brisbane, it's probably going to be Prasheed Krishna or Harshit Rana.
Yeah, I mean, it's a tough one. It's a proper conundrum at this point. And I suppose Prasheed Krishna, because he's tall, might get the nod. And I'm actually more interested in the who replaces Ashwin thing, or you go again, once again with Ashwin, because you make a fair point about Washington. Taller spinner might work over here at the Gabba. And then I don't even know if they're going to make any change with the batting order, right? Because does Rohit come back to open? Do you kind of fit Jurel in somewhere or give Sarfaraz a game or stick with the same batters? I feel like there is a very strong risk of India panicking at this moment. Whereas, you know, Australia haven't shown us that they're invincible by any means. They could go down to the Gabba. So maybe they just need to be a bit patient, honestly, over here, India.
Yeah, India could make no changes and I wouldn't have any issue with that at all. I know the, what do they call them in India? The netizens, the cricket netizens would be upset. But that's, I would not have any issues at all if they did that there. I'd feel fine with that. So they're a better side than they were in Perth right now, and they lost. Like, yeah, sometimes those things just happen and you have to accept that and shake it off and move on.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's see how things unfold at the Gabba. I don't think we have any more super chats today. There is this one bloke in the comments, Good to Great, who really wanted one of his comments to go up. So, dude, either it's a really fun sort of comment or you give us a super chat. That's when you'll come up on the comments, right? No hard feelings.
I mean,
but anyway,
that's what the wagon wheel's for anyway. And scoreboard are things that we take more comments. This, we've been talking for 52 minutes as it is. And I was going to say, should we take a break and come back and do 20 minutes on England, New Zealand? Or do you have, is that just physically impossible for you to do on the fly?
Yeah, that's physically impossible for me to do because I have to go eat dinner and then record another show with Assam.
That's physically
Otherwise,
impossible.
I was down. But no, we could probably do it tomorrow,
you know what?
If you're free.
I might try and get someone like Dylan Cleaver to come on and just have a chat to him, because I saw quite a bit of the first test. Yeah, I'm trying to remember which is which. I didn't see as much of the second test, but like, we talked heaps about England last time because they were the story. But New Zealand's now the story, like, of how the fuck do you beat India 3-0 at home and you go up against a Brighton cast-led team? And I don't want to slag off Brighton Cast. I'm a big fan of him as a cricketer, but you just beat India in India with Bumrah. And Brighton Cast comes to your home and literally tears it down. And, you know, you panic against Harry Brook. You know, Bashir, I mean, we could go on and on. I mean, I don't even know what the final scorecards are of this last one. But I was just like, what is going on with New Zealand cricket at the moment? How have they managed to do this in such a short period of time? I don't. Their form is absolutely batshit insane.
I mean, it's up and down, up and down. They had England for, what, 43 for 4 or something, and yet they got their asses handed to them in this this match in Wellington.
This year.
But anyway,
I might be
later if you want to do it with me or Dylan Cleaver.
Just before, like, I'm right in saying this, right? They lost to Sri Lanka, then they beat India.
Yes.
They've lost to England, and earlier this year, they lost to...
They defeated South Africa.
They defeated South Africa. It wasn't properly a South African side, whatever. And they lost to Australia.
Yeah.
Like, so in a year in which they have beaten the hardest team to beat away from home in modern cricket, and perhaps one of the hardest teams to beat in the history of cricket at home, they have managed to lose to a goodish English side, a goodish Sri Lankan side, an Australian side where Cameron Green and Josh Hazlewood was probably the major difference against them. And if you remember back at one stage in that South Africa series, that there was a test match where I reckon South Africa were like 200 for 4 against them. And I was like, holy shit, South Africa could steal one of these test matches against New Zealand here. Like, I mean, what a stupid year of test cricket we have had in general. And New Zealand are the cherry on the stupid cake.
Yeah, I mean, it is really, really bizarre how they win unwinnable games, which like seem unwinnable from the offset. And then, you know, you'd probably back New Zealand at home versus England, especially when New Zealand have won 3-0 and England have lost a series in Pakistan. But, you know, Test cricket has been that way this year. So I almost expect it to go batshit crazy. That's just basically the moral of the story over here. Anyway, thank you to everyone in the comments section with all of your interactions, and to Sheraton KD for the one super chat that we got today. That's it for this podcast. We'll be back live soon enough. I'm not sure who's going to be doing the England-New Zealand test, but Jared and I will discuss it later. I'll be back on literally live in like, an hour.
Yeah, you're
less
back
than
on
an hour. 45 minutes. Yeah, I'll be on with Mohammed Assam to speak on Bangladesh.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I'm going to do. So thanks, everybody. And just a quick reminder, you can go to goodareas.co and bookmark that web page. And that can prove to be your one-stop shop for all the work that we do as part of this team, whether it be written content, podcasts, or videos. We'll see you soon again, very shortly, 44 minutes to be exact. But that's all for now. Goodbye.
Thank you for listening. This podcast has an ad-free version via Patreon, where there are also many other extras as well, including a Discord channel where you can chat to me directly. There is a link to the Patreon in the show notes. We are an independent podcast, so support us any way you can. Maybe give us a review, subscribe, or share on social media. All of these things help us. And when it comes to podcasts, word of mouth is always the best way of making it grow. If we had a guest on, chances are their socials are in the show notes. Please support everyone who comes on this show. I am Jared Kimber, and this is my network. But we also have hosts and co-hosts like Bairam Kazi and Estelle Vassadevan. This network is overseen by Nick McCorriston, and each episode is produced by Ishit Kaburka at Sound Potion Studio. Mukunda Bandredi, or Muku as most people will know, is the head of our YouTube channels, and he also helps out with so many other things like the podcast recordings. And there's so many other people we could thank here, but I just want to thank all the listeners and all the people who help behind the scenes that make this podcast work. If you make a lot of content like me, you will need help. And that is why we use Minvo.pro, a slicing and dicing tool that uses AI to conjure up great clips from your podcast chats and meetings. If you make content, go to Minvo.pro to cut it.